Welcome back to the Munich and Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. With me tonight is Pierce Bauer.
What's up, John?
We've been on a hiatus for the last few months. I've been extremely busy running a rec basketball league that longtime fans will have long heard me chat about during the fall and the winter seasons, if they've listened to the podcast, which of course, I mean, we get so many emails and letters from diehards just wondering where we've been, what happened, what's going on in the movie club. It's the first break we've taken in, good Lord, 10 years, as far as like our regular writing on our website, munichmovie.club. And it was well deserved, I think, and desperately needed on my part. And it's the end of 2023 as we're recording this. And it's time for our usual best of list. So what better way to re-spark our love of movies than to talk about some of the best ones from this last year? That's been an extremely interesting year, potentially a critical turning point year for movies. Pierce, what have you thought about 2023 cinema-wise?
I think the word I would use is robust. Like, I just think there's been so much good stuff, and some of it really great. But I think this is the first year, you know, 2020 was the true drought, right? Or 2021, I guess those 2 years were like when I always think about my year end lists, which I'm in the midst of tinkering with, you know, still till the end of the year. But I always think about, like, in comparison to previous years, like, where would this movie have ranked? And I think there's like a handful of movies, maybe even my top. Like, my top 10 movies, I could make an argument for being the best movie of the past, any of the past, like, 3 years. So I think it's, the top is very heavy, but there's also a real depth of, like, you know, going, I have probably 30 movies that I think are genuinely, like, enjoyable, interesting, worth watching, which is way more than any past year. So overall, a very good year. There's a couple of interesting, like, themes, I feel like, with some filmmakers throughout that we can talk about when we talk about certain movies, but yeah, as a movie year, it just feels like it's back.
I'm more positive on 2021 than you. That's been my favorite movie year of this 4 year old decade. But 2023 would be in second place quality wise. There's been a lot of great stuff from a lot of great directors, both people that I'm extremely familiar with and people that I've never heard of before. And it's also been an oddly encouraging year for just the movie business in general. The box office receipts have gone up this year. The stuff that made the most money is not the stuff that you would expect. I think this year is the definitive end of the superhero era based on how Aquaman 2 is doing. And P.S. I'm pro Aquaman. I like the first Aquaman movie. I'm not rooting for the second one's success or the second one's failure by any means, but I am rooting for, like, superhero movies to fail in general, and that wish has been fulfilled many times over this year, with a couple of major exceptions that are exceptions because they're not just doing the same old crap. They're doing new stuff and are therefore interesting. That being, and like, the other side of that coin is that there were huge strikes this year that really halted a serious amount of momentum that was happening in the summer. Very disappointing there. And the fall, like September, October, were dominated by, like, Taylor Swift.
Yeah. And
deeply depressing slate of movies in September and October.
Yeah. Something I've been thinking about recently is, like, as in the last couple of months, is like, I feel like with the coming back from COVID, with movies, you know, being release dates being pushed and and then with the writer's strike, this whole similar thing is happening, and who knows what the next year will look like. Like, there are some movies that have been pushed, and then you have to imagine there was delays, so there will be probably another drought of release or something like that. And I just think, like, the marketing of movies now is in such an interesting place, and maybe is the defining factor of, like, this past year of film, right? Like, you look at something like Barbie or the Eras Tour, which are both kind of like triumphs of just movie marketing. And I watched both those movies. I thought Barbie was very good. Taylor Swift, I'm not necessarily a fan, but, like, the release of a movie is now important. And then I think we're going to see that revert back again in response to the strike. And then I hope that, you know, like, again, when movies are at full strength again, hopefully that means good news for theaters. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes, it should all trickle down. Like, the release window has, like, continued to shrink, and a lot of movies, like, I think The Holdovers is available for rent right now.
Yeah.
Saltburn, I think, is on Prime. So, like, these theoretically should be award season movies that are playing in, like, the dead season of January, you know, between, like, PG-13 horror movies that may or may not star animatronic dolls.
Yeah, I would. There's a recent frustration I've had in the last, like, specifically, like, the last 2 weeks, where, like, I really don't understand why just, like, every good movie is being released within, like, a 4-week period. And I'm even, like, I'm a teacher on break, and what I do with my breaks is usually I go to the movies. And, like, even I'm, like, there's, you know, I actually have watched a good amount this year, especially in the last week. But, like, why is Ferrari coming out on Christmas Day? That movie should come out in the end of July, right? Like, I have not gotten a chance to see that. It's, like, third on my list of 3 movies I have left to see in a theater. I don't think I will see it. And it's, like, that's a whole other discussion maybe, but there's just, like, why, the past 4 weeks, maybe the average moviegoer would go see one of these movies, and the ones that were in theater this past week were, like, not even the ones I would tell them to go see. Like, it just is a confusing, somewhat frustrating thing. But the good news of that is that there have been a lot of good movies, especially in the last month.
Like, in the last week, there's been...
Yes.
Like, my list of movies to see over my Christmas break, that, like, when I get a few extra days off of work, was, like, 10 movies long. And the theater in Atlanta was showing Eyes Wide Shut. I didn't get to that showing and a lot of the other showings, because you can probably hear it in my voice, and I'm a little under the weather. But that's significant, just to, and I could definitely see some of the movies that are still in theaters that I've already seen again, over again. Thank you, Regal Crown Club, for that. So... I don't fully understand the glut around this time of year. It seems gluttier than the typical year, but maybe they're just trying to, like, overwhelm the consumer and make them feel in their bones that, like, oh my gosh, the tyranny of too many choices. Clearly the movies are back, and then hopefully that sentiment lasts until, like, February, late January, when these movies start to leave theaters and are replaced basically with nothing. Like, I have no idea what's coming out in the next 2, 3, 5 weeks until, like, Dune in March.
Right. Yeah. So Dune, which was supposed to come out this year, you know, imagine a year with that, you know, so that's, like, even an outlier, I guess, or an anomaly.
Yeah. Like, what would be in that spot if not for Dune? I don't know. So, ending on a high point, 2023, pretty good year in context. So we're going to do our usual format for best of, where I talk about a movie that I loved, Pierce will talk about a movie that he loves, and we'll go back and forth. And 2.5 hours later, we'll see where we are. So my first movie that I want to talk about is Hayao Miyazaki's quote-unquote final movie, because his last final movie was in 2013 with The Wind Rises. But 10 years later, he has released another movie out of Studio Ghibli called The Boy and the Heron. I have seen this twice. I've seen the subtitled and the dubbed version, and both are great. This ranks amongst my highest Miyazaki movies, maybe in the top 3 or 4, I would say, along with the obvious ones like Spirited Away and My Neighbor Totoro. And it's in the top 3. Boy and the Heron's in the top 3. It's about a young boy in, well, like a tween boy, teen boy, adolescent boy in World War II Japan. His mother dies in a firebombing. He goes to his father's estate in the country to get out of the cities that are very dangerous. And he encounters a parallel spirit world that his family has had a lot of encounters with in the past. And he wrestles with what his life is going to be like, what it means that his mother died at this young age, how his family is going to adjust to it. And it has all of the Miyazaki tropes. I say that as lovingly as I possibly can. with like the weird little guys who are running around, subverbal, cute as hell. It's got the strong female characters that aid the boy in his journey. And it's got a spunky little girl for him to be led around by in the spirit world. It's got creatures. It's absolutely beautiful. The score is, I think, the best of the year by the usual Miyazaki composer, whose name I don't have in front of me. And I absolutely loved it. It just hits on one of the other best movies of the year was Godzilla Minus One, which we're not going to talk about unless it's on your list, Pierce.
It would be the one that just missed my top five. And yeah, and we're going to talk about my entire top five coincidentally.
Great.
But I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's in my top 10. A very nice companion piece with the boy and the heron about how the world keeps getting destroyed, sometimes by Godzillas and sometimes by people. And the next generation has to figure out what the hell they're going to do with this ruinous landscape. And I took Shane's larger child to go see it. And we talked the whole way back. Well, more accurately, I talked the whole way back about about what one generation gives to the other and how each generation has to decide what they're going to do with it. Extremely deep. I absolutely loved it. I loved it. Pierce, have you seen Boy and the Heron?
Yeah, I got to see that earlier this week at our beloved North Dakota Mall. I saw it subbed. It was as far as viewing experiences at North Dakota Mall goes, it was not as bad. But it was cheap, and that's what matters. We've talked Miyazaki on here. I don't know if we ranked Miyazaki ever, but I know we've talked Miyazaki. And yeah, I'm a big fan, and I think this movie, I have a lot of thoughts on it because I just saw it, and I really haven't gotten to talk about it yet. But I don't know. It's a tough one to pin down because I do think I'm on a long list of movies. I have it at 11, which again is like still could be adjusted. I don't know. It's a movie that I think the only real friction I had with it was just in its storytelling, which I've kind of been reading on, and I understand is maybe more of an Eastern style of storytelling versus our like what we're accustomed to with like a Western narrative where it follows a real like understandable plot with, you know, understandable exposition, whereas this movie is far more dreamlike and in a good way. That it's something we've talked about before of like there are movies and filmmakers that think they're making a movie that feels like a dream, and then there's like guys like, you know, to actually use this comparison correctly for once, like it is David Lynch-esque where it really does feel like a dream, which is really awesome. And that's the part of the movie that I really liked is just how, I don't know, that just how he's able to evoke that feeling in a way that is, you know, again, through animation and these very, essential elemental like themes of like you're saying, like he just has such an interesting outlook on the world. And I think this movie displays that again. And I'm fascinated by that. But I just think as a movie, you know, there were parts that just, especially the first, like, I don't know, however long, like there's the movie is kind of like split into two of like, there's the real world. And then there's the boy enters the threshold into the, whatever we call that world. And I think leading up to once you're in that other world, it's obviously it's magical and you're kind of entranced by it. But leading up to that, I think could have been improved. But, you know, it's tough for me to say, like, I heard someone else describe it this way, and I think this is very accurate, which is like if you're a Miyazaki fan, you've seen the movies, this movie fits in the canon in such a great, fascinating, thought-provoking way. And again, it's assumed this is his final film just based on like what he said and his age, and that's a reoccurring theme with many filmmakers this year, which I think is interesting. But I think if you were like just to watch this movie on its own, and I was to not think about the other Miyazaki movies and how the motifs that this continues and how they interconnect, then I would find it challenging, right? And like not in like a bad way. So, you know, when I watched this, I immediately went home, and then that night I watched Spirited Away, which is my favorite Miyazaki movie and just one of the best movies like ever made. And I did think that movie does accomplish a similar thing, not necessarily in its messaging. Like, I think Boy and the Heron has a lot more grander thoughts that it's trying to get across. Mm-hmm. But I think just as far as the movie goes, and again, back to like narratives, that's just such a flawless, kind of perfect, epic Bildungsroman, like a Wizard of Oz or Alice in Wonderland. Like, it just is that kind of modern fairy tale. Whereas this one, the story, the narrative was just a little tougher to get on board with, but it still is very great. You know, it's very, I'm still thinking about it, and I've wanted to talk about it because I'm fascinated by him.
The aspect of it where you have to know about the person who made it somewhat for to really click in, just for Miyazaki to be like one of the last Japanese directors who spent some amount of time in Imperial Japan, even though he was only like 3 or 4 at the time. He's talked about how he remembers like flashes and bits and pieces, and this isn't his exact story, but he did move from a city to a country estate at some point. That's like really, really the only similarity. But directors like him, like his deceased partner, Isao Takahata at Studio Ghibli, like whoever, the guy who directed Battle Royale, anybody who came of age during that period of time or was a child during that period of time and can watch all the adults do this, do these extremely destructive things, and in turn witness a lot of very personal destruction. I think Germany's not making those kind of movies. There aren't Germans making those kind of movies, not really. I find that perspective so interesting. I haven't seen like a lot of the 40s movies from this period. Bicycle Thieves, of course, I've seen that, where like Italy or Germany or any just like ruined post-World War II country coming out of it. I'm extremely interested in that perspective, and not only how, and this played a huge part in Godzilla Minus One as well, mm-hmm. not only how you are reckoning with like the devastation of all of it, but also the like revolutionary sense that we are going to build the world over again. And again, I'm talking more about Godzilla Minus One in this respect. That same theme is in Boy and the Heron, but it's more metaphysical and spiritual.
Yeah.
But in Godzilla Minus One, they are literally building the world over again. And even though nobody has any, and nobody has anything, and everybody's ruined and poor, and their family members are dead, they all just kind of have to now rely on each other. And maybe we don't have to revisit the same devastation in the next generation because we all remember what it was like.
Yeah.
And of course that never happens, but here or there, it's, you know, it's, and Miyazaki is like a depressive person, which just makes him so much more interesting as a like a human character. So as far as like, are the blocks going to get rebuilt in the correct way this time? Are they going to stand up? No, I mean, he doesn't think that, but the optimism of like the Boy and the Heron is that at least we'll have that moment where we can think maybe they'll get rebuilt correctly before the Parakeet King comes in and like slices them in half.
Yeah. To just Miyazaki as an identity, as a filmmaker, is like, I think so badly people want to think of his movies as like this, their own kind of like Pixar or just like any master animator. And it's so not, right? And I think this movie, you know, something notable that I don't really ever nitpick like this, or I don't really care about this, but like, I think it is a great symbol of like, you know, the title of the movie, The Boy and the Heron, is the American title, but the Japanese original title is How Do You Live? Which is in reference to a novel, and in the movie it's referenced. And I just think that is such a better title. And frankly, like, I do think this movie is, for American audiences, called The Boy and the Heron because it's trying to sell children on a movie about a boy and an animal, which is like what children's movies are. But really, that central question of just like, why do you go forward? Why, like, and that comes, and not to spoil if I guess any listeners have not seen the movie, but like, that is the central dilemma at the end of the movie, is like, or the ultimatum of like, the boy has a choice to go back to the real world, which is full of suffering and pain and whatever else, you know, hitting yourself in the head with a rock. But he chooses that, you know, and that is, to me, like, everything else in the movie, if it made narrative sense, if it didn't, that's, you know, that's ideally I would love a movie that did. But for a movie from this filmmaker at this point in his life to pose that question and display it in such a creative and interesting way is a masterwork, you know, it really is. And mm-hmm. The more I'm talking about it, the more I love it. But again, like as I was sitting in the theater, there are definitely parts that felt strenuous. So that's why I waffled on it a little bit. But I think if you were not a Miyazaki fan and this was like the first movie you saw of his, you would not watch a second. But I think if you've watched the others and then you watch this, it is such an interesting meditation on the themes that he's, you know, parsed throughout his career.
Yeah. And like as far like the specifics of what is and isn't happening, like, and you probably feel the same way, but just like I've seen Spirited Away like 5 times. I've seen it within the last year. If someone plunked $10,000 in front of me and was like, draw out the plot of Spirited Away for me, I could not do it.
Yeah, not really. It's more traditional, but I get what you're saying. Yeah.
And like I'm sure I could watch The Boy and the Heron a dozen more times and still think to myself, do the Wara Wara make any sense within this world? Like, I don't know that they do. Probably not. It's like ripped out of Pixar's soul, kind of one for one.
But
don't care. They're cool little guys. They're weird little guys. You gotta have. But also,
in such a more like truthful and acid tinged kind of way of like. I remember in that scene with the, what are they called? The what?
Wara Wara.
But the whatever birds are attacking them, and then to get the birds away, that some of that they have to lose some of the Wara Wara, like they light on fire as well. That's like such a more complex idea than like, I don't know, fucking anything in a Pixar movie, but that, and whatever, you know.
What's the first thing on your list, Pierce?
Well, I'm going to go, so we're doing 4 movies, right? Or 4
each. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, okay. I'll start with my number 5, which is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which I can't remember if we talked about on here before or not.
I've talked about it with JR on a mid-year best of. So I'll let you talk about that.
Well, I mean, there's not like, it's not, I mean, The Boy and the Heron in comparison is like a much more interesting conversation because there's more interpretation there. The Spider-Verse is just simply good. Like, I just think it's such a, it was, you know, for much of the year that would have been my undeniable number one. But it just is a really great execution of, you know, you talked about the death of the superhero movie, and I'm fully with you on that. I will piss on their fucking graves once that trend is over. But like, I just think this movie is phenomenal. I think it's phenomenal on multiple levels of like, obviously the animation style is inventive and new and fun to watch, but I think the storytelling of it is really good. I think the like actual themes and what it's trying to get across, it does so very well. And I just think it's very watchable. And it comes from me. I don't know if you could tell from my like previous Pixar comment, I guess. I'm not like a total cynic, but as far as like animated movies or like children's movies, frankly, or like family films, like that has really never been my thing. And I get grief for this from like my high school students when they'll ask me if I've seen like, I don't know, like Encanto. And I'm always like, no, because like I'm a single adult male who doesn't have children. Like, why would I watch a children's film? So for one to penetrate that, like actually like feel, which like I understand there are ones that I do really like, as I'm saying, like, and this is one of them. And so I just think it was one of the best movies I saw in a theater, both for the like visual style, but also I just think it was so kinetic and just such a great, I just think they've really nailed something with that movie. And so it made my top 5 there.
Yeah. I've raved about Spider-Verse in the past. That has not lessened since watching it. I saw this twice in theaters. I've recently written a review of it on MuniCMovie.club. Hard A, an incredible feat of animation that, you know, we've learned was born out of oppressive overtime and ridiculous deadlines. But the proof is in the pudding. It's a great piece of work that, you know, someone developed carpal tunnel syndrome, sure, but the memory of their pain-free wrists is up there on the screen for all to see. You know, I kind of I kind of want to see how the whole thing resolves. It's hard to imagine there being another 2-hour movie in there based on where the movie ends. But I'm not writing a Spider-Verse movie, so what do I know?
Yeah, I know when it came out, that was like kind of the one piece of criticism that seemed to ring, you know, through people's reviews of like, oh, it's not a complete story. Like, it ends on a cliffhanger. And I was like, I don't really care. Like, I don't feel
that way. I don't think it detracts from Across the Spider-Verse at all. I think it could potentially, I think there is a good ending to the, within the first movie. There's a thing that I kind of want to happen as a dismissal of superhero movies instead of an embrace, mm-hmm. where like the embrace is that, you know, you can save the day. And this might be simplistic. Maybe I haven't thought this through. Whereas the rejection is, no, you can't. And I would like to see the rejection on screen for the biggest audience possible, maybe as like the final nail in the coffin for superhero movies. Like, this has all been a fantasy. This has all been a power fantasy and a waste of time. And it's made us worse as people. And we can do something else now.
Yeah. And I'll state my case very clearly here, I should say. It's like, it's not that I hate like superhero movies. It's that I hate like the monolithic style that we have that is just oversaturated the entire market of not just superhero movies, but like blockbusters, genre films, whatever. And so to see a story that is centered with a superhero and it do something like visually different, stylistically different, tonally different, that even just like this movie is very funny. And it's funny in a way that is different from like a Marvel movie, Robert Downey Jr. quippy kind of way. Is like, it's almost reassuring that it's like movies can still be big and exciting and fun and not be like the same as a Marvel movie has been, you know? And that's like really where my biggest frustration lies, is that it's just become a monolithic style that we have just now been subjected to, which is a bad style, I think. And so this movie just breaks the mold, and that's really what I think is most valuable about it.
Yeah, we're in the same spot with that. Like I really liked the Batman from the Robert Pattinson Batman. I think mm-hmm. the Suicide Squad, the James Gunn one, is a fantastic movie. Full stop. One of the best superhero movies of this era. But it's just totally overextended itself. Like with the most recent example with the Marvels, I like everybody involved in that generally. I don't know the actress who's playing the youngest Marvel because I haven't watched a TV series as a prequel to a movie, and I would have had to watch not just that one, but I think 3 TV series, like seasons of television, to be fully up on what's happening in this movie. And that's mm-hmm. ridiculous. That's absurd. And I do think that's where they all went wrong. All these Marvel movies, they just overextended themselves.
And you know, we can end this conversation after this.
Yeah, and never talk about
other movies. But I just do think it's also noticeable, like, to talk about overextension, that like the Batman and is it the Suicide Squad or no the
the Suicide?
It's okay. Both are. But this is a great. I walked right into this great point. Those are both just stories we've seen before, but they just tacked an article to the title and got a different person's point of view to direct it, which is fine. And I liked both those movies too, but it's just like, I've seen a Batman story told like this. But like the story of Miles Morales and the type of story they're trying to tell and the style of it, I do think is just totally refreshing. So yeah, I totally agree that it's like overextended, but this movie goes against the current maybe.
My next movie is May December. This is Todd Haynes's new movie. Todd Haynes of Carol and Dark Waters and Wonderstruck, Far From Heaven. This guy probably made his name with female-led melodramas, like especially Far From Heaven, which is, you know, like set in the 50s, and it's about a well-to-do housewife who finds out that her husband is gay, and because it's the 50s and live in Connecticut, like, she can't really do anything about it, and She responds by getting closer, just friendly, really, with their black gardener. A lot of stuff happening in Far From Heaven. It's kind of a movie that could have been made 50 years ago, and it would have been exactly the same. But with Todd Haynes, he isn't just necessarily imitating that. He is bringing it into the modern day for a reason. Like, why did he choose to make that movie? He could have made a lot of different movies. And with May December, it very much has the tone of a movie like Far From Heaven, where maybe could have been made a long time ago. It has a lot of the style of melodramas, like dramatic pans in with the camera and big dramatic soap opera music. And it's about essentially the Mary Kay Letourneau story, where a school teacher molests, rapes, whatever, one of her students, one of her middle school students. And she goes to jail, gets out, reunites with him. They have a family and stay together for years. That's not exactly what happens in May, December, but that's basically the gist of it. And it takes place in the present day, where Natalie Portman, playing an actress, is visiting Julianne Moore as this perpetrator in the present, when she's pretending everything is normal and she's about to be in a movie about this incident. And Julianne Moore is married to her, you know, former teen friend, played by Charles Melton, who I'd never heard of before this movie. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a movie that is lurid and trashy, but it's extremely smart in that it is none of those things. It's sad and pathetic, and it really sticks a finger in, like, true crime culture, where that this movie would even be made in the first place, that Natalie Portman is interested in, and that Natalie Portman would be the person who would crack the code on this woman when she is, as the movie slowly reveals, a C-list actress at best. Natalie Portman is interested in the husband, Charles Melton's character, but the movie very much is. And that's, I think, where the true crime commentary comes in. Is like, who gives a shit about this predator? She's not interesting. There's nothing happening with her. She's just deeply selfish and oblivious.
Mm-hmm.
The person who people should be interested in is the husband. What happened to this guy? How this affected him? And it's just one of these movies that someone could watch and take the completely wrong message from. Not that to say that I'm 100% correct necessarily, but just like it feels like it's in this Fight Club vein, where a listener of My Favorite Murder would be like, oh my gosh, that movie was so much fun to watch. What do you think happened to her? Was she really raped by her brothers? Like her psychotic son says to Natalie Portman.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a true reading to it that has utter disdain, not only for Julianne Moore, but for Natalie Portman as well, and that viewer. And I have so much appreciation for that kind of movie.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there at the end, which is that the movie is not on either character's side, right? And I won't spoil it, I guess, if someone hasn't seen it, but I think the final scene, is the perfect, like, period on that sentence. Like, it just says, it's Todd Haynes telling you exactly what he thinks of what Natalie Portman's character is doing, and how we as like a society, as an audience, how we watch these things unfold, things like tabloid culture or scandalized, whatever, and the way we sensationalize it, and then the truth behind it. And you're right. And that all works, I think, because Charles Melton, his character, his acting is so good. Like, I know it's been kind of a hot film Twitter thing to be like he's gonna win an Oscar. I don't think he will, maybe. Like, I just don't think he's a big enough star, which is maybe, and Todd Haynes, you know, as a filmmaker, like, I like him a lot, actually. And I think he has a really keen understanding and a way of portraying just like pop culture, and our, like, his movies are kind of not referential or like winking, but you can tell, like, he kind of understands what he's making in a way that, like, really, I don't know. It's like you were saying before, I guess, is like, he knows what statement he's making. You know, mm-hmm. It's not a movie that is left up to any ambiguity necessarily. And I think there's like similarly, like I'm Not There, that like his take on Bob Dylan his music. Like I really loved his Velvet Underground documentary as well, which is like one of the more interesting music documentaries, which I'm a big fan of. And I think that's the best, one of the best. So he's like, I think it's just like a thing of like, he understands the statement he's trying to make through the story. And I think it's also very purposeful that he, you know, I'm sure there's many reasons for this, but like, this is not a biopic of whoever that real teacher that really did this is, right? This is a movie that's commenting on that thing that happened in our world however many years ago. And he's just, and it's such a, I don't know, I don't want to say like, it's not like a perfect or like a, it's just like a very astute, thought-provoking like observation that he has now made into a film. And I think that's like pretty successful.
I mean, he surely picked this incident on purpose. Mm-hmm. I think just because it's so cut and dry. Like the genders are swapped. So people think it's, I don't know, cute or empowering for the boy, when it's just so clearly awful. And that same kind of thing happens, you know, like Adam Sandler made that movie kind of about the same thing, where he's
the cobbler.
No, the cobbler. But that's my boy with Adam Sandler, with Andy Samberg.
Is that what that movie's about? I've never seen that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He had sex with his teacher as like a 13-year-old, and she went to raise the kid who turns into Andy Samberg. And it's an Adam Sandler comedy.
I see.
But that was years ago. That was 15 years ago. But I that vein is, I think, still around. That idea that this would be the best thing that ever happened to like a middle schooler. And I think Todd Haynes has a good sense of, you couldn't make this. Not only could you not make this movie if it was about, you know, the swap genders, but it's just fundamentally a gross scenario. There's just no way around it. And the fascination with it, I think, probably still grosses them out. Like, I feel like everybody has one of those. Like something they remember from 20, 30 years ago in like a You're Wrong About podcast kind of way. Like, wow, that's how everybody reacted to this thing.
Well, it's just very like of that 90s tabloid, whatever type of, you know, like you could do this type of revisionist, like looking back about any number of things from like specifically, I feel like the 90s were, you know, whatever it was of like the OJ trial is like the biggest one of these, right? Where it's just like this super sensationalized new real life event that does involve crime in some way. And because of the sensational nature of it, the true criminality gets lost, right? Like, or even something more vapid or shallow, like Brangelina, you know, like even things, just whatever these things are, Britney Spears, like pick your poison. Like, I think this movie is kind of a really great statement on just that type of culture of looking at, you know, like whatever you want to call it, like, yeah, obviously a crime, but also just a atrocity of what's happening to this teenage boy. And instead of like reacting in a rational, thoughtful way, we sensationalize it and we eat it up and we put it on TV and on magazines and we want to make movies about it. And then, you know, I guess that last scene of the movie really makes that statement on what he thinks of those movies that are made about them.
The last thing to say about May December is that it would be all well and good if Charles Melton did get a lot of praise, a lot of credits, a lot of accolades for this role. But I think the true hero in the supporting cast is the actor who plays Julianne Moore's adult son from her previous marriage. I have no idea what this guy's name is. He looked vaguely familiar. Don't have his name in front of me, but every choice he makes in the movie is the correct one.
Him?
He has like three scenes, and it's just, you can't take your eyes off this guy.
Yes. Him cutting off their conversation in the restaurant so he can go back on stage to sing Tightrope by Leon Russell was like the weirdest, best musical cue of any movie this year that I did not expect. And I love that song. It's just bizarre.
Fierce, what's next on your list?
So for what my number four movie would be is Past Lives, which we have not talked about on here. Or at least I have not. Have you? I don't know if you have.
No.
Okay. I mean, this is, again, like a movie that, you know, when it came out, was one of the best. It was like in talks to be my easy number one. This movie is so great. And then as the year went on, just so many more good movies came out. But I just think it's a deeply, maybe this is a fraught kind of shallow term, but I just think it's such a deeply human movie. And I just, it really does that so phenomenally. It's just a story about two people, really three, but like at its core two, and their feelings for one another and their longing for one another, and just the way that time and space and location just changes those things. And I just think it does that very well. Celine Song directed it and wrote it. And I had never, again, like, she's a new filmmaker for me. And so as far as debuts go, I don't know if it's actually her feature debut, but as far as like, for me, yeah, I thought so. But it's just phenomenal. And I think it's the type of movie that will probably, I know it's on the lot, it's probably on a lot of critics' year-end lists, but just as far as Oscars, and again, like we were talking about, just like so many good movies have come out in the last month. It's just like, I feel like a lot of people probably didn't see this possibly, and especially if you didn't see it in theaters. I don't know where it's streaming or if it is. And so it's like, this is one of the best movies of the year, and we might not talk about it again for, you know, until Celine Song makes another movie. And it's just so good. And the lead performances, Greta Lee, she's a breakout, I think, of this movie. Like, I think she's going to go on to be really big. But it again, like, it's just a simple story about two people and their connection. And then a third, you know, eventually a third character. But it's really those two central characters, I just think, I don't know, I just think it tells such a simple but such a deep story about them.
Yeah, there were several South Korean movies this year, or movies about South Korean characters who are dealing with being an immigrant, wondering about their life if they had never left the country. It was this and Return to Seoul and, oddly enough, Joyride. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I haven't seen it.
Joyride was not very good. Return to Seoul, I think, was my favorite of those three movies because it was extremely acid-tipped. I wouldn't say Past Lives is this year's Drive My Car or After Sun, i.e. the movie that is in everyone's top three, top five, that left me completely cold, because it didn't leave me completely cold. I like Past Lives a lot. I agree with the Greta Lee stuff. I knew her from several comedic roles that I had seen her in, from stuff like Russian Doll. And she had a very small role in Sisters, the Amy Poehler, Tina Fey movie. But she basically stole the whole movie from him. And this is the first thing I've seen her in where she's like playing a dramatic role. And yeah, she's great. I think it's certain that she's going to get like a Best Actress nomination. And I think the movie will do quite well as well in like the other categories. But
yeah,
I didn't take a lot of profundity out of Past Lives necessarily. I don't think there's anything specific necessarily to. I don't think there's anything specific to this exact scenario in the sense that everybody has alternative paths, even if they haven't moved across the country or moved across the ocean. I don't necessarily find that idea particularly compelling. Everybody can always do something different. Everybody has, you know, multiverse stuff and all that. We've been living with multiverse ideas and storylines for like a decade. So I just don't find that particularly compelling. But as far as like a well-acted movie, yeah, absolutely.
It's similar to like After Sun, which is a movie I did like, but I get that. But like just that, like, its simplicity, that it is just a movie that is about people and their emotions, and there's no, it doesn't need to be wrapped up in some grander idea or in some grander genre or whatever. And I just think it's a very good execution of simply that. And yep. Which does not necessarily warrant like best movie of the year, but it is just, every year it becomes maybe less and less that we just get a movie like that. So it's just, it's very good.
I mean, I think it's between this and Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon as far as, like, consensus best movie of the year.
Critically, yeah. I think, but maybe, like, total population-wise, like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no. Far from. Yeah, right. But yeah, I mean...
I think there's literal orders of magnitude separating all three of those movies' box offices.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing we can talk about later on. But, yeah, I can see that. I really do think the Oscars will be telling... Again, because it is a pretty stacked Oscars year, I will say. Like, there really is a possibility, based on what I've kind of read and seen as, like, projected it, that, like, all 10 Best Picture nominations will be possibly movies that I enjoyed, which, like... I don't know if that's ever been a thing, you know? So it's like, if this movie can make it in those ranks, not being released in the, you know, later part of the year and whatever, that'd be pretty great.
My next movie is a French/German movie, Anatomy of a Fall, directed by Justine Triet, who I've never heard of, starring Sandra Hüller, who I have heard of. She is in another movie this year that is, I think, yet to be released outside of, like, New York and LA, The Zone of Interest, from Jonathan Glazer, which has a extremely strong chance of being in my top 10. But she stars in Anatomy of a Fall as the wife of a husband who is found by their son in their mountaintop cabin with his head smashed open in the snow. And the movie is about, like, what happened to this guy. Did he clearly fell out of a window of their house, but did he jump? Was he pushed was he pushed maliciously? Was he pushed accidentally in the middle of a fight? And Sandra Hüller's character, she is arrested and put on trial in the extremely interesting and confrontational and highly entertaining French justice system. The movie, I think it lands in the exactly correct place as it continues. It has to rope in their son as far as his interpretation of events. And, just when it comes to legal thrillers, when it comes to, like, marriage dramas, I think this is like top tier, absolutely top tier. And again, I in the last, like, 5-10 minutes of it, hairs on the back of my neck standing up, like, is this movie going to tip in one direction or the other? And it, like I said, chose to do the exactly correct thing. Pierce, have you seen Anatomy of a Fall?
I have, and it's like right outside my top five. I really, and honestly, as time has gone on, it's in the top tier of movies that I've just revisited thinking about the most since I've seen it, because I think what it does so perfectly is it is a movie that is almost like inverse to what May December, what we were just talking about with that film, where, like, that movie has a pretty clear statement, I feel like, on on its subject matter, whereas Anatomy of a Fall is such a perfect movie that leaves the interpretation, the answers to the audience, to yeah. You, the viewer, right?
It leaves you with... but its statement is vague. It is purposefully vague.
And there's there's a literal version of that where, like, there is a bit of a whodunit, I guess, in some way. And that's not necessarily, I'm not just saying that it ends the movie without that resolution. It's not just that. It's that it leaves you questioning whether she did it, whether she didn't, would it be justified, would it not be justified, her son, how does he feel about it? Like, it's just a movie that it does something that maybe some of the best movies do, which is that, like, it just poses questions to you. And then you are left to kind of, you know, much like the silly dressed French lawyers, like, you must take the evidence, piece it together, and come to your own, I don't know, what does a lawyer come to? I got to finish this metaphor.
Summation?
Summation, yeah, sure. What do they call it when they, like, verdict, that's the word. Yeah, and I guess lawyers don't come to verdicts. Whatever, you get my metaphor.
Yeah.
That made as much sense as the French court system did, which I want to talk to you about. But
yeah, go for it.
Well, what the fuck are they doing over there? I mean, this movie is great because getting to watch that was very entertaining. And it does do, in a serious note, this movie does an incredible job of just making, again, just a courtroom very thrilling.
The knock on foreign movies is that they are boring and slow. And I recently saw a Finnish movie called Fallen Leaves that is the driest romantic comedy that has ever existed. So I get that argument, and I get why people would think that. Anatomy of a Fall is one of the most entertaining movies of the year.
Yeah, and it makes it entertaining and thrilling, not in like a Few Good Men way, where like people are screaming and like you know, like it's not like that. Like, but there, but so it is very successful at that. But then on the flip side, just like being an American watching this, it's just insane the stuff that they do in this court, where like you can just like question the defendant. I guess is she the defendant? Is that what it would be? Yeah. They're just like while someone else is testifying, they can just turn to her and be like, hey, is that true? And then she'll say something, and then they'll like counterpoint. It's just like, what the fuck? Like, which, so that whole part of it is like fascinating in a way. And there is like, I would say there's like one key, and I imagine most people have not seen this movie, so I don't want to spoil it, but there's one key like testimony that happens at the end of the movie that you're just like, this would never, I cannot imagine this would ever be admissible or, you know, anything, but it happens, and it's well acted, and it's very compelling, so it works in the movie. But it is like, that's the only real logistical stretch the movie takes for me. Do you know what I'm talking about at the moment?
I do.
But it's still very good. And the kid in this movie gives one of like the best kid performances, like, you know, I've seen. So yeah, it's a really great movie.
This is the second French legal drama I've seen this year after Saint-Omer. Saint-Omer is about a, I believe, a Senegalese French woman who has a baby with a French man who sucks, and she's very isolated, and she exposes her baby on a beach when it's like a year and a half old to die. Mm-hmm. And the movie is her trial, and two data points is, I don't know what the term is exactly. It's not a coincidence, but I'll go ahead and call it a trend, because how many more French legal dramas am I really going to see this year? I think this is just how it goes. Like, it's just a very open, emotional line of questioning. Like, they're very interested in internal mental state in France, the French legal system.
There's a whole,
and a big part of this movie is like they go over the physical evidence, and it's just inconclusive. They cannot tell. So once you reach that point, you can't just throw your hands up till the trial's over. You have to continue to like delve into what these people were thinking. And with Saint-Omer especially, you get the sense that if like she says the right things, she might get away with this. And I don't say that to be like, oh boy, what a tragedy that would be. Like, that's also a good movie that has a lot of interest and patience and understanding and empathy for all parties. But that seems possible in that movie, and it seems possible in this movie.
There's
someone could say the right things, irrespective of whatever the law is, and the jury would find in your favor. Which I'm sure is kind of true here, at least as far as the movies are concerned. But I don't know. It seems like in America, we're really like bound with minimums and you X then Y. And because of a lot of good and bad reasons, we've tried to like suck all of the subjectivity out of the law.
Yeah.
Whereas in France, it seems like bring on the subjectivity.
Yeah, I'd be curious for our friend Shane to watch this movie, and I'd love his lawyer's perspective. But yeah, I don't know. There's a whole, I think to me the most fascinating part of this movie is there's a whole section of the trial where they're reading her fictional writing, and they're trying to draw connections from these fictional stories. She's an author, and like trying, and like you were saying, like understand her mindset. And it's like the way the movie does that and the way it unfolds is just like a really interesting kind of question of like authorial intent and like, fiction.
We're going through this in Atlanta right now with Young Thug's trial.
That's true. Yeah. Exactly. Like, you know, auto fiction and authorial intent, all these things. It's like, it's just so interesting to have that posed within a movie and for it to come. It's not that it doesn't come to a conclusion, but it just, the movie does the perfect amount of giving, where it's up to you to piece together what you think about this. And that's
some and of the best movies. And if it matters, if it even matters what you think.
Yes, that's a great
how
point.
How important is it, really?
Yeah.
It kind of it puts to shame American legal dramas. I don't know that there's a lot of movies in France. I think that the vast majority of French movies, in my experience, are extremely personal, like this family dealing with X, this young adult dealing with Y. More genre stuff out of France, please.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also falls within that purview very much, because it is a family going through something very specific. It's just happening on a much broader scale. Pierce, what's your next movie?
So I'm going to jump ahead. I'm going to jump my number three, because you're going to talk about that one later on, I believe. So I'm going to go to my number two of the year, which is The Holdovers, which I'm very fascinated to hear what you think. I think you, well, I'm not going to predict, but I really liked this movie. And I understand if someone maybe didn't. I've heard some pushback to it, but also I've heard, you know, there's a lot of praise for it. But I just think this movie falls, in some ways it falls into my, not necessarily my interests, but more of my, like, what I want out of a movie. And it just perfectly falls into the category of, like, they just don't make them like this anymore. Mm-hmm. Which is just, like, it's a bit of a comedy. It's a bit of a drama. It is just simply characters and people. And you know, I like Alexander Payne movies. I think this is one of his better ones. Maybe his best, even. And I just really loved it. I loved the story of it. I thought the acting was incredible. I think Paul Giamatti, of course, is really great. But Dominic Sessa, who plays this kid, right? So it's, I guess for people that don't know, it's the story of, it's like a prep school or a boarding school up in like Northeast, like outside of Boston somewhere. And Paul Giamatti plays the curmudgeon kind of teacher who is not liked by students or his coworkers. Dominic Sessa plays a kind of rebellious student. And he has to stay over the winter break at the school with the teacher and the lunch lady played by Divine Joy Randolph. And it's just, similar to Past Lives, but not as simple. Like, it is just a human story. It's about loneliness. It's about connection, finding that connection in, you know, the found family type of shit, or the just over the holidays type of, you know, loneliness that we feel. But I just think the performances are great. And I think the writing's really strong. And it's the exact type of genre that I love. And even the style that it's filmed in makes it look closer to like a Hal Ashby movie.
I was thinking Hal Ashby, exactly.
And you could argue that's a little on the nose even, but like, I don't think that's a bad thing. But it is definitely in that realm. And I like those movies. And I just think it really hit for me. And I think Dominic Sessa, I absolutely could argue that that's my favorite performance of the year. You know, at least top three. And he's in like he literally was an unknown, like he was a student mm-hmm. at the school that auditioned. And I just think he's so good. And the message of the movie, I could, like, you know, I've heard is like, yeah, it's a bit simple, I think. Right. It's just a simple movie about like loneliness and like these three unexpected people become friends by the end. Like, yeah, that's whatever. But I just think it's a good movie. And it's the type of movie we just don't fucking get anymore. And so I really liked it.
I love The Holdovers.
I could see a world where you came out the other side, but I liked that you liked it.
I'm pro nice core generally. Not that this movie is nice core, because it is quite bitter, in a lot of ways. But I haven't read any like this movie is manipulative, this movie is sentimental, whatever. I heard someone say this movie is like a Cat Stevens album.
I was going to reference this. That was Adam Neyman's Letterboxd review. I was going to reference that.
Does he mean that negatively? Is that a bad thing to be?
I think it's a little both. It's like being beaten to death by a Cat Stevens album is what he said. And I think there's a good to that and a bad to that.
That's like a solid way to go, to be beaten to death by a Cat Stevens album. I don't find the message, such as it is, to be, or the theme or whatever, to be like cloying or sentimental. I think it's just, I think it works through the characters in that, you know, like, what is the theme? It's like every interaction you have with somebody, you have the opportunity to make their life better or worse.
Mm.
And the characters in the movie frequently are encountering people both within the events of the movie and previously that have made their lives worse. And much like with the boy in the heron, it's like, how do you live? You can.
I was going to make that connection.
Go ahead.
It's saying like, you know, where the movie ends up, especially, is like the world is shit. But you go forward anyway, and you just, like, he doesn't say it in this way, maybe, but, like, the world is shit, but, like, give them hell anyway, you know? Like, yeah. I don't care if people don't fucking like me. Like, I love what I do, you know? And like, Giamatti's character develops over the course of the movie and, like, comes out a different side of that, maybe. But for the Dominic Sessa character, it is just, like, the world's going to hate you and be difficult and work against you, but that's no reason not to live, you know? And it's, like, I don't know. I just think that the sentimentality of this movie, again, just like really worked on me, especially for the holidays. Like, it's a great, I wish this movie, like, this is a good example of, like, I guess whatever streaming service this movie is on, like, maybe families gathered around and watched this on Christmas Day or whatever. But, like, if just like four less movies came out in the last 4 weeks and this movie was still in theaters, that's the movie I would recommend to everybody. Take your family, go see it, because mm-hmm. you'd love it. And it's just like, why is that movie not, whatever, you know, that should be the big Christmas movie, but it's obviously it's never going to be. But
I think yeah, it's done really okay, but that's like a 20 million versus like what, like a 70, 75 million.
Yeah.
It's just, like, I just feels wish like more it could have easily got to that point with like the correct marketing and word of mouth and that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. it is where it is. I don't think it's in theaters anymore.
It's theaters. Yeah. But it's just like, it's the type of thing where it's the type of movie that I truly think like any adult could watch. Like, you could watch it with your family. You could watch, you know, if you're into, you know, something like a Past Lives, I would say is not as accessible, or even a May December is like, you know, like maybe you don't watch that with mom and dad or whatever. Right. But yeah. The Holdovers is something that just like anyone could watch and enjoy. It's like it's been like my most recommended of like, oh, you're looking for something to watch like with your family over the holidays or just with your whoever. Watch The Holdovers. It's great. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you feel something. It's a holiday movie, and the performances are great. And across the board, like Joy Divine Randolph, that character I think could have been really hokey and like really preachy in a way, and I don't think it's that at all. And Paul Giamatti, you know, my one, like, as I was watching the movie, this isn't even a knock against it really, but it's maybe just a note on it, is that like, this character is like almost absolutely the same character from Sideways, but just like instead of wine, he's really into like the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a bad thing. Like you get to watch Giamatti like kind of come back to this role that really, like, I don't know if it made his career or defined it, but really propelled who he was as an actor. And he gets to like return to that style of performance is really great. And he's phenomenal in it. And I think in a just world, like I would possibly vote for him for best actor. Like, I think I would definitely say Dominic Sessa should be nominated, although I don't think he will be, but yeah, any of these three performers.
I think Giamatti will get nominated for best actor. I don't think he'll win.
Yeah. I think, but if any of these three performances won an Oscar, I would say that's justified.
Yeah. If you were making bets, like it's Divine Joy Randolph. I think she's won a lot of, like, there haven't been precursors yet. But like a lot of critics groups are like unanimously behind her,
mm-hmm.
Which would be fine, which would be great. I don't know what song is, I guess you would say, like the recurring theme song of the movie. I think it's Modern as opposed to like a 70s pull.
Yeah, it's in the trailer.
It's in the trailer.
Yes.
Just song. Every time it kicks up, it just so perfectly puts you in this like New England barren snowy prep school landscape of just pure melancholy, and it's a funny movie for the most part, but just underlying everything is that barrenness, and it really like I just don't understand how you could like buy into that tone that is all over the entire movie and come away with thinking, boy, that movie was sugary crap.
As a filmmaker, like Alexander Payne, I think did the exact right thing, which is like the last like decade of his movies, I haven't really loved. Right. He had a couple of misses, I think, and then some that people like, but maybe I'm lesser on. But I think he did the right thing, which he just reined it in. Right. It went simpler. right? It's a three-person movie about a simpler kind of story. It's not, you know, what was the downsizing?
Yeah.
You know, like, that's the type of movie he shouldn't be making. He should be making this. And more filmmakers should make movies that are just like this, that are just comedy dramas that anybody could watch and enjoy and are not, you know, I don't know if we're going to talk about this movie. I'm sure I think it's really high on your list from what I recall. But, like, Wes Anderson with Asteroid City, a movie I liked, but I just think he's trending in the different direction where he's going bigger, less structured stories, like getting more inventive with it. And I just kind of wish like a filmmaker like a Wes Anderson would make his version of The Holdovers, which is more like a Rushmore, you know? So it's like, I just think that's just the right move for a guy like Alexander Payne.
A different director who got his start in the late 90s is at the top of my 2023 list. And it is, oddly enough, Christopher Nolan, who has never made a movie at the A level before Oppenheimer, for my money. Oppenheimer, that is the singular cinematic experience of 2023 for me. Biopic of J. Robert Oppenheimer from his college days through the 60s, but primarily about his function as the lead of the Manhattan Project. This is what Christopher Nolan needs to do forever after. He needs to land on these historical moments and devote a lot of resources to them, a lot of practical effects, get a cast that has Oscar winners in like 5-minute roles, and earn $1 billion somehow with an extremely talky, narratively broken historical biopic. This is fairly easily my favorite movie of the year.
I have this at number 3, so this is the last over. I really liked it. I think, like, as far as the highs of this movie are incredibly high, but I do think there are some mids within this movie as far as, like, as a full movie goes. It's absolutely, I think, one of the best. It's tough for me to say with Nolan. Like, I'm not like a Nolan bro. Like, that's
stupid. Yeah.
But, like, I mean, I do love, like, The Dark Knight. I just love that movie. Like, I just think that's a fun movie. And, like, this is obviously a more thoughtful, you know, movie, a more fully complete movie, probably. But, like, you know, it's tough to say if this is, like, his best. But I will say some of his best work is in this movie. But then there's stuff, like, for me, where I rubbed against it is that, like, final third of the movie, which is not bad, but it is just, it's what Nolan kind of does, which is, like, it just plays with the convention of storytelling a little more than I needed, and it overly complicates things in a way that distanced me when I was watching it. But it's absolutely really great. I don't want to talk down on it, but I think Cillian Murphy or Cillian, whatever, a shoo-in for best actor, frankly. I liked Florence Pugh and everything she did. Emily Blunt is very good. All the performances, Robert Downey Jr., across the board were really great. But for me, like, when the movie is all of them out in, what was the name of the town? Los Alamos. That third of the movie, basically, because it's kind of chopped up that way, that third of the movie is just, like, the best stuff Nolan's ever done. Like, that's pretty fucking great.
Yeah. It really hit me on a competence porn level, on like a flattering the viewer level, where maybe I brought some knowledge into the movie, or maybe I was able to follow it, but I just felt locked in with what was happening. Like, to the point where I could, like, predict the next problem. And again, maybe some of that is just rudimentary knowledge of what happened. And like, sidebar on that, like, I convinced my parents to see this movie. My mom liked it quite a bit, but my dad, who I think has read the book that this is based on, his main note was they didn't talk enough about gaseous diffusion, which apparently was a big problem for them to have. So he's bad at watching movies, fairly impenetrable as far as connecting to anything happening outside of the lab in Oppenheimer, which is extensive, but in that realm of other knowledge that I'm bringing into this movie, like, one of my favorite documentaries from the last 10 years is a movie called Particle Fever about the discovery of the Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland from 2013. And like, that movie is about that thing, but it's also about physics itself and like the battle within physics between the theorists and the people who like sit in the lab and do the mm-hmm. applications. So much of the movie is about that without putting like too heavy of a thumb on it. Mm-hmm. There's all the stuff with communism and where the world was with communism in the 30s and the 40s as well. And again, some of this Boy and the Heron holdover stuff, like the world has been destroyed. What kind of world are we going to make out of the rubble? And the like the way that these scientists are thinking about the world that they want to create, but the decision has been made, like many levels of bureaucracy and leadership above their heads already. Like the cowardice of trying to play the middle and being a moderate. I just pulled so much stuff out of this. And a lot of that moderation stuff comes out of that final third, to the point where I feel like if I saw it again, I could make a really strong case for why that has to be in there.
Yeah, it's a difference between the choice to include it and like just the way it's done, the execution. But again, like that's a minor fault of it. But for me, like to put a point of comparison in it, like I think what the strength of Oppenheimer the movie is, and credit to Nolan, is that it does what I think a really good biopic should do, which is that it is both telling the events of this person's life, but also contextualizing it within in comparison to their work, right?
Yeah.
So like everything in that first third of the movie about who he is as a person, his dabbling in communism and his relationships and all those things are then contextualized within the actual work he's doing, the not understanding the effects of his own actions or not being able to understand the consequences of your actions is like a reoccurring theme within his life that makes sense. Whereas I don't know, and we don't need to talk about this movie much for very long, but as a point of comparison, a movie that fails to do this is Maestro. I don't know if you saw that.
I haven't. Like,
that is a movie that just totally fails to connect to that pipeline of like this, the work or the art or whatever this historical figure contributed, and then their private life, their real life, how that influenced it. And it just like totally fails at that. But Oppenheimer does that really well. And that's, I think, the biggest strength of the movie. Where if I could say the biggest fault of the movie, the number one, like maybe the worst thing I've seen in a movie this entire year, is a single moment from Oppenheimer. Do you know what I'm about to say?
Is that the Destroyer of Worlds thing?
No, okay. Although that was kind of laughable.
Yeah, whatever.
Much worse than that, I thought, was the superhero movie-esque Easter egg reveal of the young senator from Massachusetts.
I don't know why it was in there. Yeah, that's
a like, that can fuck right off. Like, that was so lame.
Everything that could else be the difference between an A plus and an A. Honestly, I'm like 3 weeks away from writing a review of Oppenheimer, so there's a very slim outside chance that I bump it up into like the very rare A plus zone.
Yeah.
But that line will probably keep you from doing it.
That not like that's fair, but really honestly, like that moment is a little emblematic of what I do bump up against in the whole Robert Downey Jr. section of that movie. Which is that it is just trying to do a little too much, like a little too much sleight of hand for something that could just be way more straightforward and still entertaining. You know, the Rami Malek thing, or the just like the whole like double crossing reveal, flashback to the Albert Einstein by the lake, like all of that stuff was just a little too much in like hour three of a movie. That the first, you know, that everything else in this movie is really humming. And then that just kind of bogged it down a little bit for me. It shows a real sign of like Nolan moving in a direction I much rather prefer than the previous stuff.
And results wise, no conceivable difference. Like this is not a one for him in any way. Like this is one for everybody. Like just everybody came away from this with the maximum payback and clout and whatever. So maybe this is the new superhero movie, like the high profile, you know, like huge cast biopic. Although I don't know if you've seen Napoleon.
I didn't. That's one of the ones I've just skipped altogether. I don't think
it's. I am a huge Ridley Scott fan. Right. I know it's popular to say that Tony Scott is the better Scott brother. I find that to be ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Napoleon might be the worst movie that he's made.
Okay. Because you're a big Francophile, I remember.
I am. And I have like major problems, of course, with Marie Antoinette mm-hmm. from a recent episode. But I at least really appreciate that movie. There's just nothing to really appreciate in Napoleon. One of my bottom five movies of the year.
Dang. I took it off my watch list. I was like, I don't need this, but very at some point I'll watch it. We'll see.
Wait for the director's cut, which I'm sure is coming.
I do love a Ridley Scott director's cut.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go.
Yeah.
What's your last movie, Pierce?
So my number one movie of the year, which we have not even mentioned yet, to me, it's a real testament of just like truth and storytelling and why we make movies. It's the incredible true story of a former government agent turned vigilante who embarks on a dangerous mission to rescue hundreds of children from traffickers. you know, I've been sitting.
Finally.
Yes.
Take that, liberal media.
Yeah.
Media Movie Club is finally talking about this.
Number one pick, Sound of Freedom, of course. I bought out multiple theaters worth of tickets throughout
the year. Good for you. You're a true patriot.
Yes. Yeah, well, no, you know, the Jim Caviezel, he's the real hero. But me, I'm...
yes,
no, I did not see that movie. But I have been staring at that IMDb plot description for, like, the entirety of this pod waiting to say that. Just waiting.
All right. You picked the right moment.
No, but the best movie I watched this year is a movie that I think does empower the idea of like truth and storytelling and why we make these stories and who tells them, which is Killers of the Flower Moon, which I just thought was colossal and epic in a way. And, you know, obviously there's like the aspect of the story of just the total corruption and disenfranchisement of the Osage Nation, like the weight of the story itself obviously comes with that, but I think the skill with which it is told and the style in which the story is told is purposeful and correctly like subjective in a way that is just like, I don't know, I thought it was pretty phenomenal, I guess. And then the flip side of that is just to put this movie within Scorsese's career. You know, Scorsese, one of my favorite directors, one of most people's favorites. But for this to be the movie that he is possibly ending on, or at the very least, like in later in his life, he is making these very totemic, large, encapsulating stories about stuff bigger than what he's done before. But it still fits within, you know, this is still just a story of creed and corruption, which you could say about Mean Streets or Goodfellas or, you know, Wolf of Wall Street. Like, they all are of a piece, yet he is still able to do something that feels totally new, totally inspired, and not about, you know, mobsters in New York City, right? Mm-hmm. And I just think it's phenomenal. The performance, like, Leo is great. Robert De Niro is great, but Lily Gladstone, you know, if I really was talking about my top three performances of the year, it's Lily Gladstone, it's Sessa from Holdovers, and Melton in May, December. Like, and all three of those are like new faces, relatively, you know. But she's really just like, the level of performance in this movie is really great from her, and like where it fits within the story. Her character is like so broken by the end of the story, so devastated, yet it is not a performance that is like, you know, over the top or exclaiming or screaming. It is just you are watching a person, a people get just totally hollowed out, and then you are just watching them do it. You know, you are just along for that, you know, along for the ride, I guess sounds like a positive thing, but you are along for the ride in the worst way possible, right? And I just thought it was the most emotionally affecting movie of the year for me, and I just think it's one of the most masterfully told stories of the year.
This is in my top 20, but I came out of this movie. I came out of this movie kind of thinking that Lily Gladstone's character, and I, some of this is just the perspective of the movie because it is so in the perpetrator's heads.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of thought she was a fool for like big chunks of it. And not just her, but a lot of the Osage in this community. Mm-hmm. It's clearly obvious to the viewer because you're hearing them talk about it. You're in the room when Lewis Canselme is like, I want to kill these kids. Can you promise me that I'll get their head rights if I do kill them? Talking to like a lawyer or something.
Right. Yeah. No, I think you're...
Why doesn't that motivation appear obvious to the Osage? I didn't have enough from them. I didn't have a sense of... There is a thread in the movie that they are turning away from their ancestral ways for like the kind of funerals that white people have. That's in the movie. But why are they doing that? They're consciously choosing to do that. Why? Mm-hmm. Why? Why is
that? Well, I think that's... So I don't disagree with you. Like, I think that is... I think you're kind of meant to feel that way in the movie, right? Like, you're meant to just be like, oh my gosh, can you not see what is happening here? You know, the whole movie, you know what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think that's... I think, in a way, that's just a very honest portrayal of how this happens or how this works. And not just with, like, you know, Native people or whatever. It's just like any disenfranchised group or any, like, again, just this like nefarious scheme to infiltrate and overtake or whatever. It's like, yeah, that's like how it feels, right? It's just like specifically like Lily Gladstone's character and her family, I guess that's who we get the most, you know, point of view from, but like,
yeah,
they want to be a part of this, right? They want to marry these men and live these lives. And, but you know,
why do they want, like, they don't come off well.
I don't know.
These men don't come off well.
Yeah.
They come off quite poorly. And like, there's a very early part of the movie where it might be in the first like 30 minutes where they talk about how like the town is like full of white men who are totally useless. They have a term for them. I can't remember what it is, but
yeah,
I remember that happening pretty early in the movie. And like, why does, and not like a, not, this isn't Great Gatsby Leonardo DiCaprio either. This is like,
right,
hungover Rick Dalton at best Leonardo DiCaprio, or like in the stuck in the woods Revenant Leonardo DiCaprio. He's not at his most attractive. Like, that I felt like for good chunks of the movie, stuff was happening because it had to happen in the way that it often does in historical type movies. And I wasn't fully understanding why the characters are making these choices.
Yeah.
And I think with Robert De Niro being in a lot of these community meetings, nobody had the idea that like this guy is, his nephews are married to within this family, and like one of their wives has already died, and the sister, another sister has died, another sister has died. Like, just nobody even like voices the concern. Like, even like the most active step that the Osage take is a very sick Lily Gladstone goes to Washington, like begs Calvin Coolidge himself, the president himself, to send some help. But it's extremely vague. Like, somebody's murdering people in the Osage community. No idea who it could possibly be, but we need you to help us find out. These guys are really dumb. Isn't that the thread in a lot of these mafia movies too? Is like, everybody knows. Mm-hmm. They're all stupid. Everybody perpetrating these crimes is a big dumbass. they don't have the ability to cover up for themselves, but they don't have to, because either it's their crime is committed within an insular community who has some kind of like racial understanding with each other, or they've threatened everyone with murder if they say anything.
Mm-hmm.
But like the communities are at cross purposes, so yeah. They don't have that kind of racial bond, that racial appeal, and they're killing them anyways. Well, so I really felt like there was a lot missing in this 3.5-hour movie.
Sure. Yeah. I get that. I think some of that, I think I don't fault you or anyone for rubbing against that part of the movie, or the lack thereof of that in the movie. But I do think it is purposeful in a way that it, part of the strength of the story, I do think, is just how well, just how like unflinching it is to show like how manipulated they were, right? That it is just, it is not, like, I don't think, I guess, tell me if this makes sense, but like, there is not a redeeming quality to Leonardo DiCaprio's character, and nor should there be, right? Except for your point, which is like, but then why would she stay with him? But I think the movie works in this way where like, the legs are just taken out from under them, and the movie just shows how helpless they are after a certain point, you know? That like, when she goes to Washington, it is just this like, this you know, this infestation, this plague is within our community, and we are hopeless. And whether I agree with you that like I could not give you a good reason of like why would anyone marry Leonardo DiCaprio's character, and then also not suspect that Robert De Niro and the rest of them are responsible for this, but it's just like that must have been the reality in some way, that like that is how this happens. It's just that it is in plain sight, yet you cannot see it until it is revealed to you, right? Like, it is the notion of, can you spot the wolves in this picture? It is the idea of like, it is just all around you, and by the time you realize it, you are helpless. And I think that's what happens to Lily Gladstone's character. Now, whether that's believable or not, I guess that is like, that could be a point of contention. But for me, the scene where they reference that line, the can you spot the wolves, where is it Ernest, I think? Is that his name?
Yeah.
When he walks into the room, when he is set to testify, and they bring him into the room.
It's in the first trailer, which is the best trailer of the year, full stop.
Oh, yeah. Incredible. But just like the thing of like, and you knew this the entire movie, but it is never solidified for you until this moment, that you see every single person that is ensnared in this, you know, this web, this scheme. And you realize how much influence they have, and who has stakes in what Ernest ends up, you know, doing in this trial. Like, that is such a great reveal of just like, you as the viewer knew this entire time that everyone was ensnared in this, and that everyone was responsible. But it's that moment of walking into the room and just being like, it's exactly what you thought it was. And here it is. And in the movie, I just think it nails that. I just think it's a very, again, just like devastating, hollow you out story of like no redemption, right? Like it is not this like, I mean, like I know there's some maybe critiques of the movie from the Osage people. That's kind of understandable. But it's just a movie that it ends, the end note, the probably one of my favorite scenes of the whole year, the Scorsese on the stage play.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
What do you call that? A teleplay. Like, or no, it was not a teleplay. It was just a radio play. That is such the right way to end this fucking movie. And it just leaves you so like devastated, both of what happens in the story, but also the notion of how this story then gets told, right? Is that it becomes this fucking, you know, Hollywood style
radio. Yeah, this disposable play. True crime yarn. Right.
Goofy Foley artists and Scorsese himself being the one up there saying, and then we tell their story. You know, it's just like, I just think as a movie on its own, it's just phenomenal. And then as Scorsese, to talk about his career, like, you know, his last, what is it, 3-4 movies have been totally different, but still of a piece, where they are these reflections on you know, these long totemic reflections on, in this case, it is this story of the Osage people, but the Irishman is just the story of like coming to the end of your life. Silence, like the fact that he made Silence, the Irishman, Wolf of Wall Street, and this as like his, are those his last four movies, maybe? Like,
yeah,
that's a fascinating four movies, you know? It's just, I just think he's such a, I think there's such a minimalized way to look at his career and just think of mafia movies and like glorification of these people. And I think this movie just totally stands against that.
I don't think I've fully digested. It's good. It'll be showing up on Apple Plus here shortly, I would think. Certainly before the Oscars happens, just to get it in front of more people. I went in thinking this was going to be the movie of the year, and I left not thinking that. I do think it is the choice of perspective, which was the only choice he could have made, really, in 2023. Like, he couldn't have made, he could not have made the movie from the Osage's perspective.
Exactly. I agree with that. Yeah. Which isn't to say, I think that's where like some criticism comes in, where it's like, there should be a movie also made from the Osage perspective. Like, those movies should also be made.
This one means that movie has a much, much, much less chance of being made.
That's true. But yes, that's true. But for what he chose to make, I think it is the right decision. And from a novel, from a book that has been written, that was, you know, like, he, like the fact that he's adapting something that has already existed makes me also think like he chose this, right? He sought this out.
And so it's
the right, I think it is in his career, if this is, and I hope it is not, but if this is his last film, it is a, and this goes with this larger trend of 2023 of just like these older filmmakers making these big kind of possibly final statements on their career. This is an excellent one, I think.
He's had a violent career, Scorsese, a lot of violent images on screen. I don't think I've ever been as rattled as the explosion aftermath in this movie. Like, that was, I think that was the most harrowing image, sequence, scene, whatever, that Scorsese has ever filmed. And that's really saying a lot.
Yeah. And there's a couple of things like that in this movie. Like, there's, you know, to tie it into The Boy and the Heron, like, there is a depiction of death in this movie that is so striking in a moment of someone passing away that I thought, like, to watch that with something like The Boy and the Heron would be very...
Yeah. Are you talking about the mom?
Yes.
See, I think that... I agree that that was extremely striking. But it's not in... I just wish it was in the movie why the next generation is in no way connected to that part of their lives anymore. Because you just don't get a sense of what has been given up or what has been gained by giving up. Because you don't have... There was a middle way. They could have done both. Why didn't they do both? And, it's just a mystery. I feel like it was a mystery coming out of the movie. It's 3.5 hours. It shouldn't be... You should not leave a 3.5 hour movie with, like, additional basic questions. Maybe that was just me missing stuff. Maybe I'm asking too much from this movie that, you know, like, purposefully chose to focus on the murderers and the conspirators. But yeah, that was the takeaway. And that Scorsese is a just great actor, in addition to being great at so many other things.
True. There's a whole slew of great performances of, like, both from, like, Osage actors, but also from, like, who is the guy, you referenced him earlier, I don't know his name, and he's in, he just popped up in another TV show I was watching, but he's got such a striking face, like, such a bizarre...
The guy who sits down with a lawyer and is like, hey,
I'm
gonna marry this woman, and she's got two kids, she just died, and I want to kill the kids.
Yeah, Louis Cancel Me, is that how you say his
Cancel
name?
Cancel Me, yeah, he was in The Irishman.
Yeah. Just begging for it.
Scorsese's just found this guy, and as long as he's making movies, he'll find a spot for him.
I was fascinated by that dude. Yeah, I'd never seen. I guess he was in The Irishman. But also, like, Jason Isbell's great in his, like, role. I liked the Brendan Fraser stuff, even though I know.
So did I. Yeah, I don't know what people were talking about.
That was great. That was Jesse Plemons. Like, everybody. Like, they're all. It's all very good. It was a good movie. I loved it. Can I give some? Are we done?
I don't disagree by any means. It's a great movie.
No, John, you hated the movie. Everyone heard you. It's okay. Can I give some honorable mentions of some stuff? That, so, like, in the past, like, 2 weeks, I guess, I've been really catching up on a lot of, like, stuff that just, like, either didn't play in theaters, but I now have access to. But, like, a lot of foreign films, but also, like, smaller stuff. Like, really loved How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I don't know if you saw that.
But I did.
I think that is just, like, a really well-executed movie on, like, a really good scale of, like, you know, it's not going to be the biggest movie of the year, but it's maybe one of the best, most well-made, just with what it had. Kelly Reichardt's Showing Up. I don't know if you saw that.
I did.
If you were a Kelly Reichardt fan, this movie is very good. If you are not...
Yeah, of a piece with her previous work.
Yes. But, you know, a different type of movie. Like, it is just a quieter, simpler... Really, like, if like, the way I was, like, Past Lives is a simple movie about people, this is, like, an even simpler movie just about people and how you fit into your little world. And then, like, Passages, which is a foreign film featuring Fran...
all that, yep.
I didn't love the movie itself, but I think the performance from Franz Rogowski, I think is how you say it, I think he's just, like, a fascinating performer. Like, I've seen him... and other stuff, and I that's why I watched this, and whatever he does next, I'm watching. So
we keep talking about Oscars, costume design, Passengers, best.
Oh yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah,
the outfits are quite key in that movie.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great point. And then not a movie, but just simply the best thing I watched this year. Like, the better, even, I think, for me, my personal favorite over, like, even Killers of the Flower Moon, season 2 of The Bear, I just think was, like, the best thing I watched. So, shout out to that.
I think I liked season 1 a little better.
That's fine.
I think the highs of season 2 were quite high.
Yeah.
Probably the best, like, 3 or 4 things the series has done thus far all took place in season 2. But I think I like the total package of season 1 a little better.
That's fair. I think that's a fair point. But season 2 felt way more like it was more like not bottle episodes. I know there's a lot of discourse over what that means on Twitter, but more standalone, like following this character just briefly. Like I was, when the season dropped, I was traveling through Europe on my own. And so I watched the episode, now I forget what it's called, but the episode where the Baker like goes to Copenhagen.
Yeah.
I watched that like alone in an Airbnb in Brussels, and it just destroyed me. And not in like a deeply emotional, but just in like a destroyed is the wrong word. Like I just so resonated with it, and just there's multiple things like that throughout the season. I just thought it was the best thing. I that show is top tier for me.
I did a Seven Fishes feast myself.
Oh.
In the last week, and. I neither drove a car through the front door nor spread butter on a piece of bread with my hand, which I think was the most horrifying thing that happened in that whole episode.
Is there anything better than in that episode when John Mulaney, when the two guys are trying to pitch John Mulaney on like baseball cards? And here's what's so great about that show is that scene, which I do watch frequently. That scene ends with him just being like, man, I fucking love you guys. Like, and that's how you feel watching the show. You're just like, God damn it, I'm so happy I get to spend this time. I you guys are fucking idiots or whatever, but I fucking love you guys. And that's how I feel about that. I
completely forgot about that part of the episode, but just because so much happens. But yes, another great little tidbit. That doesn't need to be in there. Just flavor. Good stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
A few other movies that are going to make my top 10. Or top 20. The Killer, David Fincher.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be high up. That just pure technical filmmaking I think for a lot of people, like John Wick 4 would slot in that spot. I don't like those movies really. The killer does everything, did everything for me that I want. John, no, that's not right. The killer does for me what John Wick does for other people. I just love every frame of that movie. And I, much like I'm glad to have Paul Giamatti back in movies after he's been like on a Billions Island for however many years with the holdovers, I'm very grateful to have Fassbender back in movies as well. I've talked about Close before, a Belgian film that was nominated for an Oscar last year, but it falls in that spot of foreign movies that get nominated for Oscars, but that don't come out until the previous year. That's going to be in my top 10. The First Slam Dunk is a Japanese animated movie based off of a long-running anime there. It's a basketball game in real time for the most part. An extremely high-intensity high school basketball game in Japan with like interstitials about each of the players on the team. And it's extremely kinetic. And like take your breath and like breathtaking and stressful and highly knowledgeable of basketball to the point where like you could show it to a team and be like, okay, you need to stop doing this. You need to start doing this. Some fantastic coaching, memorable characters. If not for the boy, a fantastic year for animation. There's going to be three animated movies in my top 10 for 2023. And at the very bottom of my top 20 list is a movie called Concerned Citizen out of Israel, which is quite pertinent or quite relevant about a well-meaning liberal gay couple who live in an apartment overlooking a street where one of the partners has planted a tree. And a migrant worker leans on the tree and continues to lean on the tree after the man says, hey, I planted this tree, please stop leaning on it. Calls the cops, things escalate. How complicit is the average Israeli citizen, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of movie where you're just like, where you feel like you're in trouble because you're watching it. Where just like you have this feeling like the teacher just yelled at you on the back of your neck. It's just this very thorny moral drama that I really connected with. That's 2023. Just a small fraction of the movies that I saw this year. I really went nuts with new releases this year. I kind of stopped watching movies at home. I don't really know why that is. Maybe I need to redo my media room, get a new couch. I don't know. But Netflix stopped sending DVDs this year, so I think that's really had a part to play. All the streaming services stopped announcing what was leaving streaming at the end of the month. So that also was relevant to like me not watching movies at home anymore. But yeah, I went nuts in the theaters. I'm stealing a lot of money from Regal in the way that I'm taking advantage of their frequent user program. So happy to do that. Again, very strong year for movies. Not so much for TV. It feels like TV has become a vast wasteland in the last like 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, I counted up maybe like 10 shows I watched this year that I really liked. But yeah, movies came back strong.
Yeah, hopefully that continues. Although, I don't know. I don't know. There'll be a gap this year. I think 2024 is going to be pretty rough. But hopefully the holdovers from 2023 will like sustain us for a little bit, at least in the first half of the year.
I mean
movies that were supposed to be released in 2023.
No, yeah.
Not that we're just going to continue to rewatch the holdovers in place of new movies. Although that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
Classic mix-up.
Yeah. Check out our website, MediaCommunity.club. It's always a pleasure to talk about movies with you, Pierce. Thank you for joining me.
Anytime, John. Anytime at the end of any year, I will talk about my favorite movies of that year with you.
Yeah, we'll reconvene in a year.
Exactly.
we'll have re-upped the website address just for this. It'll have been totally worth it. Have a good night.
See ya.